This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Major events, please come to the development meeting February 4th, 6 p.m. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch at 503-231-8032. Or navigator at kboo.org. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Pioneer Square Christmas tree bomber Mohammed Mohammed is convicted of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction. We'll hear analysis of the case from legal experts.
Labor organizers in Chicago celebrate a union victory after gaining representation.
A local pedestrian rights group organizes to challenge the Columbia River crossing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 1st, 2013. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. A new bill in the Oregon legislature would add post-traumatic stress disorder to a list of conditions that qualify for medical marijuana cards. A state Senate committee is scheduled to hear public testimony on the issue next week. Oregon law currently allows patients to possess and use medical marijuana for conditions such as glaucoma, chronic pain, nausea, or epilepsy if they have a physician's approval. Proponents of the bill say adding PTSD would help veterans with the disorder manage their symptoms. Public health officials have denied requests to add PTSD to the list twice before, as have officials in Colorado and in Arizona. In New Mexico, where PTSD is a qualifying condition, 40% of medical marijuana card applicants list the disorder as their main reason for seeking treatment.
There's been a lot of controversy surrounding the construction of the Columbia River Crossing, or CRC, a proposed multi-billion dollar project that would replace the I-5 bridge over the Columbia with a widened roadway. Much of the talk has centered around funding. Oregon and Washington state legislators are preparing this spring to look at whether to provide nearly $1 billion for the project. Another point of debate has been the height of the bridge and whether it would prevent passage by large watercraft. The proposed clearance has already been upped once from 95 to 116 feet. At the helm of the permitting process is the Coast Guard, whose main focus is safe navigation for riverbound vessels along federally owned waterways. But four regional Congress members have asked the Coast Guard for something more, an economic impact report on the CRC. The representatives, all Washington and Idaho Republicans, penned a letter to the 13th Coast Guard District Commander expressing a worry over the CRC's potential economic damage. Their main concern is that the current proposed height will prevent the passage of large equipment shipped by local fabrication companies. The Congress members pointed out that these companies have supplied $200 million of the past 10 years' revenue. A spokesperson from the Coast Guard said that the district commander had no comment on the letter, which was sent on Wednesday, but its authors hope their concerns will be taken into account.
A coalition of local groups is launching a campaign this evening to try to push the state legislature to stop the mega bridge known as the Columbia River Crossing. The state legislature begins its session on Monday in Salem, and tonight the group Bike Walk Vote will hold its campaign kickoff party at 7:30 p.m. at Crank Bicycles at Southeast 27th and Ash in Portland, Oregon. Peter Welp, the chairman of the group, spoke with KBOO News today.
Governor Kitzhaber has said he wants to have a vote on the CRC by March 1st, and I think we'd be happy to let him have that vote as long as that vote goes bad. The fact is that right now they haven't got any kind of detailed analysis on the tolling plan, and most of the finances for this are based on a tolling plan. And so, unfortunately, you know, they really don't have any idea how they're going to pay for this, and right now it's kind of a crapshot as to whether it'll even work. And so we're hoping that legislatures will say, there's no real reason why we have to rush into this right now. This year, let's wait until after December when that investment grade tolling plan comes out, and then decide. Fundamentally, the thing was started years and years ago as either a way to get light rail to Vancouver or a freeway to Vancouver, depending on who you ask. But it's got a number of reasons that they say they want to build it, and those reasons don't really pan out. Bike Walk Vote is just sort of inspiring some local grassroots action tonight to plug into their efforts. They're really they've been the lead organization fighting this legally, and now at the state level. And so we're getting people together, talking about some of the problems with the CRC, and then again talking about how people can get engaged and get active on this.
That was Peter Welt with Bike Walk Vote, an organization which works to change the political landscape to support people who bike, walk, or take transit. The group's campaign kickoff event will be tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Crank Bicycles at Southeast 27th and Ash here in Portland.
Mohammed Mohammed was found guilty yesterday of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction in the United States. The 20-year-old was convicted for his part in an FBI sting operation that ended with an attempt to bomb Portland's tree lighting ceremony November 26, 2010. The defense says they plan to appeal the conviction. For details, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Lewis and Clark law professor Tung Yin.
Lewis and Clark law professor Tung Lin has been following the trial and spoke with me this afternoon. I start by asking him about the discovery of evidence.
Some of it's obviously going to be national security related to some classified documents that maybe the defense thought the government over-classified. But some of it is fairly typical just in any kind of criminal trial that one side wants some evidence and the other side wants to keep it out. And it's better to get all this done not in front of the jury. So you start off with that, decide the issues, and then you bring the jury in.
Specifically, it seemed to be agreed upon that the so-called outtakes where the FBI forgot to turn off their mic would not really be allowed to be shown to the jury.
Yeah, that one is probably going to be a point of appeal that the defense will raise. But I suppose that the answer for why the judge kept it out is, for the most part, in what we call Fourth Amendment law, dealing with sort of police-citizen interactions, the intent of the law enforcement officer doesn't matter. It's what they do or say to the person. So all the outtakes really show is, I think these are ones where the agents were sort of high-fiving that, oh, it looks like, this is good, he's good, falling for it or whatever. It's irrelevant to, their mental state is irrelevant to whether Mr. Mohammed was, in fact, trapped.
One thing in that regard that I believe Ms. Hay was hinting at least, was that persona that the FBI portrayed on the stand was also very different from the outtakes. Isn't that relevant?
It could be that starts to get too, in a sense, too complicated and tangential from the main issue, and that if you start going down that path, then the government will come back with some counter-testimony and we'll end up spending a day or 2 days having essentially this mini-trial on the issue of their persona and so on. And the judge could decide, you know what, that might be somewhat relevant, but it's going to take so much time and it might confuse the jury that it's just not worth the marginal gain that it would provide. It would entail a huge cost in trial days and in multiplying the issues and so on.
Are you privy to the judge's instructions to the jury with regards to entrapment?
I think this is probably another key issue that the defense is going to raise on appeal. The issue is this, that the entrapment defense requires the government to prove that the defendant either was not induced to commit the crime or was predisposed to commit the crime. And the focus in this case was on predisposition. And so that's why we had all the government evidence about the online magazines that Mr. Mohammed wrote for and so forth. All that was an effort to show predisposition. And so the defense, though, as I understand it, wanted an instruction. The predisposition was to commit the crime that he ultimately did attempt to commit. And that's what the argument and debate was about. What does that mean, the crime? Does it mean that he had to have the intent when the government first met him to attempt to use a weapon of mass destruction, or that he had to have in his mind that he wanted to build a car bomb and set it off in Pioneer Square. And so the judge gave a response, which the defense then thought about and contended that that response actually gave the government version of it. And so they filed a motion seeking to withdraw that note and instruction and substitute it with a new instruction, which apparently the judge did not agree with, and then the verdict came in.
The jury is really answerable to the people. As a matter of law, what he stated is not a matter of law. It's a matter of case law.
Yes, but the reason that trial judges do that is trial judges, especially federal judges who are appointed for life, they're not answerable to the public. They don't stand for retention elections. They're answerable to, in this case, the Ninth Circuit, the appellate court, and trial judges don't want to be reversed. And so the easiest way to avoid being reversed is you give the language from the very opinions that the appellate judges have written.
That was Lewis and Clark Law Professor Tung Lin. The defense will appeal the guilty decision in the Mohammed Mohammed trial, and grounds likely will include the government's disclosure of evidence was too limited for a fair trial, and the judge's instructions to the jury regarding the definition of entrapment were unfairly biased toward the government and the status quo. And this is Joe Meyer for I Love KABU News.
After the guilty verdict was announced by the jury in the Mohammed Mohammed trial late yesterday, lawyer Tom Nelson held a meeting with other local Muslims that have faced harassment from the FBI. Nelson has been a tireless advocate of civil liberties and has represented high-profile clients charged with, quote, terrorism, including the Holy Land Foundation and Brandon Mayfield. He spoke with KABU's Joe Meyer today about the relationship between local Muslims and law enforcement in the wake of the Mohammed verdict.
Since 9/11, the FBI has been basically treating the Muslim community as legitimate targets for any kind of action they think they can get away with. And the result of that has been a campaign of intimidation, of basically bullying, traps, using techniques that, in my opinion, are way beneath representatives of the United States. I keep going back, it keeps going through my head, a quote from a fellow by the name of Beria, B-E-R-I-A, who was the head of the secret police for Stalin. And he was famous for having said, "You show me the man, I'll find you the crime." I think that accurately describes what's going on right now in Portland.
Well, Tom, what do you think the origin of that is?
In my opinion, it's primarily economic. There are enormous budgets getting bigger and bigger all the time for, quote, counterterrorism, end quote. And the problem is that, frankly, there aren't enough terrorists to justify all the money. And so what you see is situations like we had the verdict yesterday in the Mohammed case. If you don't have a terrorist, let's go make one or go find one and bring them along and suck them in. It's a self-reinforcing activity. There's a lot of money. Follow the money and you'll see why they're doing what they're doing.
You mentioned it's an old practice. Are there some new patterns?
Obviously, they're much more sophisticated. Infiltration has always been one of the major things. False flag operations, all of the surreptitious activities of intelligence agencies. But now they have a lot more things going for them. For example, they can routinely and do routinely intercept personal communications, often without a warrant. And even if they could have gotten a warrant, a number of cases I've handled, they didn't bother. But that raises another issue. The judiciary, and I'm not speaking particularly about Judge King in the present case, but the judiciary overall has been just an enormous disappointment when it comes to enforcing the government's requirement that it provide citizens with, for example, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, due process rights. It is really kind of gotten on the bandwagon and said, well, whatever the government does in the name of, today it's anti-terrorism, it used to be anti-communism, it's okay with us.
Yeah, I stated repeatedly on the stand that they don't go into mosques. It's against their policy.
Oh, that's, no, yeah, the guys carrying a gun with the badge, they don't go in. But it's an open, good Lord, it's a very common practice for a number of the, quote, practitioners, end quote, at a mosque, and particularly, some of the more conservative mosques, to be on the FBI payroll. I saw that in Pete Sada's case, where the Cabral family was paid informants for the FBI. Now, they weren't carrying guns, but they were doing everything they can to forward or to advance a case against, in my opinion, an innocent individual. And they admitted it. As a matter of fact, they admitted after the fact that they had paid that person to go in. They didn't admit it prior to trial. They created the perception that, no, it was just an American citizen doing her job. But after the fact, they had to admit, yes, we paid $14,500, and we were expecting to pay more. Last week, at a sermon I attended, Adam Oz, there is a statement from the person giving the sermon. We know that there are a number of, quote, Muslims, end quote, in here who are being paid for their services for informing on what goes on. He said that during the sermon, and I hadn't heard that said before, even though everybody believes it. And he said, you know, they really ought to consider who they are, what their relation is, and whether they're doing the right thing.
You mentioned pushback in the Edgar Hoover's time. What do you see now?
The Muslim community is slowly coming to realize that if their government is going to act in a manner that is inconsistent with, for many of them, the reason that they came to America, that an appropriate response would be to stand up and say no more. Let me just tell you a brief story here. We had a situation about 8 months ago in one of the mosques where an individual was showing up and, through various means, attempting to, saying dangerous things to very impressionable 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. We heard about it, and they agreed that this should not be happening. But the question then became, what do you do about it? Do you go to the FBI or law enforcement? And the feeling then was absolutely not. God knows what they're going to do. At the end of the day, we solved that problem. We solved that problem by trying to have a sit-down with the fellow and saying, don't do this. Fortunately, the guy vanished. He just vanished. So the problem was taken care of. That, to me, illustrates why the FBI's actions in bringing the kind of cases that they have been bringing is so completely counterproductive, because the entity, the organization that's supposed to protect you from these things is setting itself up as a judge and jury before they even get to court and making so that they're not trusted anymore.
That was Tom Nelson, Portland lawyer and longtime civil rights activist. He reminded us that no person is safe in their communications, and the FBI seems to be following the Stalinist directive, find me a man and I'll find you a crime. And this is Joe Meyer for KABU News.
Complete interviews with attorney Tom Nelson and with attorney Tung Yin about the Mohammed case and about the treatment of Muslims can be found at the KBOO website after the news today.
Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. You are listening now to the KABU Evening News. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. The weather this weekend will be partly cloudy.
It's 5:19. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I'm told that many Americans long to return to the idyllic days of yesteryear, to the small-town wholesomeness of the 1950s, when everyone valued freedom, truth, church, community, baseball, and Walt Disney. Never mind that such a fantastic time and place didn't actually exist. The important thing is that there is someone today, a unique visionary, who plans to build just such a utopia for all who yearn to have a life of harmony and happiness. Glenn Beck. Yes, the walking, talking ego of the far, far, far out right. Beck has built his lucrative career on fostering fear, disparaging whole segments of our society, promoting plutocratic elitism, and spreading divisive lies and conspiracy theories. But lately, he's been humming Kumbaya and offering himself as the recreator and guru of the elusive yesteryear. In early January, he revealed that his dream is to build a place that is some hybrid of a small town, a theme park, an entrepreneurial incubator, a re-education center to instill right-wing truth in young people, and, in his words, a retreat from the world. He wants to call it Independence, USA. It will have everything, a residential area where rich and poor will live as neighbors, a marketplace with real businesses and stores, a media center for himself and others, including a school, quote, where aspiring journalists would learn to be great reporters, A ranch where residents will grow food and where visitors can learn how to farm. A theme park, possibly based on Ayn Rand's creators versus moochers dichotomy. And a church that, oddly, would be, quote, modeled after the Alamo. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a place! Of course, the downside to living in Glenn's dream world is that he'd be there too. That'd definitely spoil the perfection.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A mother has filed a $250 million lawsuit against the New York Police Department for handcuffing and interrogating her 7-year-old son for 10 hours. The boy was accused of stealing $5 that another child dropped on the playground. This accusation resulted in a fight, and school officials called in the police. They took him to the station and charged him with robbery. When the boy's mother, Frances Mendez, and her sister went to the station, they were refused the right to see him. According to the mother's lawsuit against the city and the police department, her son was verbally, physically, and emotionally abused by the New York police. She seeks damages of $250,000.
The Environmental Protection Agency has decided to ban 12 pest control products because the manufacturer failed to abide by newly adopted regulations for safer packaging standards. The manufacturer, Decon, has 30 days to request a hearing to appeal the agency's ban. Until then, the products, which include rat and mouse poison, will remain on the store shelves. The EPA retooled their safety standards in 2011 to better protect children and pets. The agency said about 10,000 children are accidentally exposed to rodent poison each year. The new regulations state that rodent poisons must be contained in protective, tamper-resistant bait stations.
As national union rates hit an all-time low, workers in Chicago are celebrating a victory that they say could point the way forward for the nation's labor movement. The textile workers and machine operators at Artistic Stitches are the first group of workers in the U.S. to unionize under the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, in the last 4 years. Organizers of the campaign say it shows the potential for the labor movement's revitalization with innovative new organizing strategies. Jorge Mujica with Arise Chicago spoke with KBOO Radio about today's victory.
What happened is that a group of workers decided to walk out of the work because they were told they would not be paid holiday pay for working on Thanksgiving, and they decided that that was just not fair. So they walked out of the job. Other than the Thanksgiving, a lot of array of problems surfaced. Every year, the employer laid them off and then rehired them next month in January. So they were, 30 days unemployed. Nobody could go to unemployment because if they did, they would not be rehired. They had problems with vacation. They had problems with the bonuses. They had, a whole series of problems. So we ended up telling them that the best solution we thought for them, it was to join a union. This is, we are talking about Workers United, which is an affiliated with SEIU. And the union said yes. They filed an election notice with the NLRB, and they ended up having an election and winning the election. This is quite important. This is the first group of workers the union has organized in around 4 years. Basically, what we have had is a whole reconfiguration of the economy. The big industries with 15,000, 20,000 workers pretty much don't exist anymore. The United States lost its industrial base. What used to be the ILGWU, International Ladies Garment Workers Union, there's no garment industry anymore in the United States. There's no textile industry anymore in the United States. Completely automated all over the place, and the unions don't have access to that kind of, to organize those workers. I mean, less than 10, less than 20 workers, less than 30 workers, the union doesn't go for it because it's incredibly expensive, it's costly, it takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication. and in the end is not worth it in terms of union dues. In this particular case, we were able to unionize the workers at our artistic stitches, but in most of the cases, it is the worker center itself that takes on the job to confront the employer, to create a small workers' association. So it is a union, but it's not a union at the same time. It's just a concerted collective effort on the part of the workers with the help of the workers' center. And in many cases, we are able to solve problems the unions couldn't afford to try to fix. So the bottom line is, you know, your own resistance or your own resilience and your not willingness to protest. Go to a workers' center, seek advice, and there's always something that is possible to be done. It may solve the problem permanently. It may solve the problem just for a few workers, but at least be something. If you just continue working in the situation, in a bad situation, you get paid less than minimum wage. You don't get paid your overtime, and you don't do anything about it. The situation is not going to solve itself. So, you know, you have to decide when and where is the bottom line and start doing something about it.
That was Jorge Mujica with Arise Chicago. Local groups organizing on behalf of workers' rights include Voce Immigrant Rights Center and WeAreOregon.org.
Two factory owners in Bangladesh were arrested today after a fire in their garment factory killed seven workers last weekend. Workers at the Smart Fashion Garment Export Factory had to break through locked doors and jump out of windows to try to escape the fire. This week's factory fire comes just 2 months after another garment factory in Bangladesh caught fire, killing over 100 workers. Charlie Kernighan of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights spoke with Flashpoints Radio about the fire earlier this week.
Our guys there were able to get into the factory right after the fire, and they gathered all of the labels and the codes of conduct, and, you know, it was all torn apart and filled with water because the fire department did eventually come. And they smuggled the things out. And, you know, that's the only way you learn, because everybody's lying. Like the Inditex, this is one of the largest apparel companies in the world based in Spain. They own the famous company Zara. And the labels Berkshire and Lefties was in the factory. So were labels from France, you know, high-end labels. And these labels then go and tell us that the workers have the right to organize, they have the right to freedom of association, to form independent unions, to collectively bargain, to have decent working conditions, no child labor, no forced labor. That was in the text. France, they tell us that defending human rights is what they're all about. You know, best working conditions for all workers, protecting children from child labor, supporting emancipation of the rights of women in Bangladesh, developing free trade. Goes on and on. It's in la-la land. I mean, these people come out with these codes of conduct. The Inditex person, the one who owns Inditex, is the third richest person in the world. So they have like a scam. It's phony as can be. They have phony codes of conduct, phony, you know, laws that the workers are guaranteed the right to organize. It's phony from beginning to end, and it's the workers who really suffer. These workers, you know, the 450 workers in the factory, they got paid, the helpers got paid 18 cents an hour, $8.73 a week. Junior sewers, 21 cents an hour, $9.89 a week. And the highest wages, the very top level, is 28 cents an hour and $13.83 and 38 cents a week. In other words, these workers are starving. They're living in misery. And around this, and also, you know, horrible enough, the Bangladesh government came out and said that they would pay $252 for each worker who was killed. So a life now in Bangladesh producing garments for Europe and the U.S., their lives are worth $252. Workers who were seriously injured, like the woman who's paralyzed inside the hospital, she got $126.02. So to have someone critically injured, their life is worth $126.02. I mean, something's got to give.
That was Charlie Kernighan of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. A call by KABU News to H&M Clothing Company about that company's involvement in the Bangladeshi garment factory was not returned by airtime.
In Guatemala, a former dictator faces trial for allegedly ordering the massacre of thousands of indigenous people in the early 1980s. Efrain Rios Montt seized power through a military coup in 1982 and presided over the bloodiest period in the country's civil war. Prosecutors have specifically charged Rios Montt with ordering the killing of more than 1,700 Mayan Indians. He will face charges of genocide and crimes against humanity, alongside another former general, José Mauricio Rodríguez. During his 17-month rule, the staunchly anti-communist Rios Montt received more than $10 million in military equipment from the United States government, as well as strong backing from President Ronald Reagan. A recent ruling by Judge Galvez allowed criminal proceedings against the former dictator to move forward after several years of immunity. Efrain Rios Montt will be tried by a 3-judge panel, which has the option of either charging and sentencing him, exonerating him, or holding a public trial. He's the first head of state in the Americas to stand trial for genocide.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Sean Stewart, Stephen Sherritt, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Linda